portfolio. But let's take a moment to listen to an NCR exclusive interview.
It's Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. This is John. You're listening to the Kill Radio News. Iraq body count for today. According to IraqBodyCount.net, number of civilians reported killed by military intervention in Iraq, minimum 27,814, maximum 31,348. Hello, everybody. I have a very special Kill Radio News Hour. We're not going to sit and read articles all hour long and hear me complain about the state of affairs. I brought a guest so we can hear him complain about the state of affairs. Luke, welcome to the Kill Radio.
Oh, anytime, John.
I have with me Luke McKissick, famous lawyer of the not-so-friendly stars and political theorist. Luke, why would I want to bring someone like you on my show?
Well, that I don't know, but I share some of the same interests you do, and I just watching your recounting the body count in Iraq, that's something I'm specifically concerned with, and I have, as you know, several one-man shows that I'm doing at Hollywood Court Theater under the auspices of First Stage. It's a theater organization you and I both belong to, and they tend to be political in nature. I cover some of my cases and stuff, and I love talking about it.
Excellent, excellent. You, you talk about your cases. Now you've had some pretty huge cases, and you also, before Fox became totally evil and insane, you were a legal consultant.
I didn't have anything to do with Rupert Murdoch or anything, but I was the legal analyst for from Rodney King in 1992 through O.J. Simpson's trials in 1997, and I was pretty much allowed to do what I did. You know, it was really with Channel 11 locally here, and there was nobody messing with me. I didn't have anything to do with what's now the Fox Network. I mean, they really screwed up. I wouldn't have anything to do with them. I hope.
Yeah, they're completely loony. It's not even news anymore, really.
No,
I mean, it's
it
just
really
is
just propaganda.
It's a show.
Yes, it is. It's just
pure
a right-wing
entertainment.
Show. Absolutely.
Not unlike this.
Yeah, but it's not very entertaining, you know. It's just one-sided propaganda.
Well, let's talk about Iraq, because I love talking to you because you always have such great information about Iraq. And tell me about your thoughts as we started to get into this whole thing, and you were watching the news. And tell me about the first moment you knew we were going to go to war and what you thought about it.
Well, I suppose it would have been maybe early. I suspected we were going to go to war like maybe a year or so before it actually happened, but certainly by the early spring, I mean maybe January, February of 2003, it was very clear that we had our engines revved up and we were hell-bent on going over there. Because once you get people in a war mood, you know, you can do virtually anything because people operate from fear. In one of my shows, I bring out some things that I think are sort of fascinating, though. I noticed you just recounted the body count. But I think the Lancet magazine, and I think it was November of 2004, estimated there's probably more than 100,000 civilians whose deaths could be attributed to the American invasion. Because it's, I think you really have to take into account all the problems that occur over there that really legitimately can be laid at the doorstep of the Bush government. The interesting thing out of that, fascinating statistic out of that Lancet article, is that persons living in Iraq today are 52 times more likely to suffer violent deaths than before we invaded. That's 52 times. And we're not talking about, you know, one time or two times. I mean, 52 times. So,
wow.
I mean, so I don't see how we can talk about all the great things we've done for them, either in terms of democracy or making the place safe or so forth, because it's just clearly not the case.
Well, you know what's funny? What's interesting about that is I was watching the news today, and they were showing, they're replaying Bush's speech that he gave recently to the veterans of foreign wars, which is just that as a concept, is, you know, screams irony. Mm. But one of the things he said, and you know, obviously his speech was basically about two things, really. One was about what a great job the Iraq War, what a great idea it was, and how perfectly it's working. And the other was about how the media should be more, you know, quote unquote, responsible in the way they point out what an unbelievable prick he is. But the thing that really stuck with me was that he said that there was some sort of study that they did recently in Iraq that said that 7 out of 10 Iraqis are happy with the way their lives are. And it just blew my mind. Like, I should move there, like, tomorrow, right? Because I'm here in L.A., and I don't know 7 out of 10 people that feel that way.
Yeah, you know, you wonder, that's true. And you wonder who you talk to. It reminds me a little bit of, this is before your time, I think, but they used to have an ad that was, it said, like, 9 out of 10 doctors smoke Camels. And it wasn't even true that 9 out of 10 doctors smoked. So, I mean, that was obviously what they meant to say, if assuming it was true, that 9 out of 10 smokers preferred Campbell's of the doctors. I don't know how they got that statistic either, but I mean, I think, I don't know how much.
You can't even find 10 smoking doctors anymore, though.
No, that's true. I want to get the rent in Iraq. Assuming you can pay for the bodyguards, maybe that's sort of cheap over there now.
Yeah, well, anything's got to be better than the rent in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, maybe it makes you happy. Maybe it's the fact of seeing a bunch of people killed every day is something that just keeps your spunk going. I mean, it must be some reason, because it can't be those people are dying over there every day of that happy.
Well, do you ever think about the future of Iraq and wonder, okay, maybe I'm being too cynical, and what's done is done. This invasion was illegal, and it was horrible, and we shouldn't have done it, and now they're in this horrible situation. But in the end, you know, if there's a democracy that comes out of it, you know, do you start to fall into that fantasy where you just can't be unhappy about it anymore? Or can you really stick to what's in your heart and just picture this thing spiraling
even
further out of control?
Well, I find that really, really difficult to believe. I think that we have to realize that it's not to say that Saddam Hussein is a good guy, but what he was is a buffer between radical Islamic Iran and radical Islamic Lebanon, and with Syria largely on that side also. And he ran a secular state, believe it or not. I mean, he had Christians and Kurds and Sunnis and Shiites. Of course, he favored the Sunnis, but he had a very secular government and a very pluralistic one. And it's unlike the Ayatollahs in the neighboring area. And that's a power vacuum there. And to me, what's going on now, I would classify it as a civil war. Now, they don't like to say that, but I don't know what else you can call it. I mean, I guess you could define a civil war in such a way to eliminate this being one, but then you're just, you know, trying to reach your own desired result.
So you think what we keep hearing about, wait, let's wait for the fire engines to go by in deeply, deeply underground internet radio. Welcome to L.A.
You know, there are no fire engines in Iraq, you know.
So do you think we're being fed a big lie that there even is such a thing as an Iraqi? Is there any sense of unity in, like, oh, I'm from Iraq? Or are we really talking about a small group of very different peoples who a long time ago, not too long ago actually, but long in terms of my lifespan, were via Sharpie placed in an area on a map and called Iraqi. And then they were put under different leaders against their own will over history. And now what we have is this this sort of phony democracy under military occupation. And we keep hearing on the news in America, we keep hearing about the Iraqi people and how great they're doing. And yet, yeah, everything is blowing up every day. And the Iraqis themselves, like, do you think there's any unity even within Iraq? Even if it's a unity against us?
Well, I think there's a unity there in terms of being opposed to the United States. I mean, you recall when they toppled Saddam Hussein's statue, and I think they, naturally, anybody who was opposed to the American military wouldn't have been within a million yards of the place, but they had maybe 700 or 800 people there. There was a time, I guess maybe about a year ago, that there were like 400,000 people in the streets of Baghdad saying, Americans, get out, Yankee, go home. So I think that's about the only unity I can see. But to comment on what your earlier thing, yeah, the whole idea of these states in the Middle East, I mean, they're all artificial to begin with. I mean, they all are outgrowth of the victors in World War One. You know, England and France, they just carved it up. You know, and then in this particular sheikh and so forth would get, sheikh would get an area, and they draw lines in the sand, and it made the Saudis happy because they got this, and then there's Kuwait and all this stuff. These are all artificial anyhow, and Iraq comes into existence about 1920. And whoever's there, they're in power. And yeah, you've got a lot of groups that historically are quite different and never got along. I mean, the Kurds, and then they're the Shiites that are, you know, feel close to Iran. And then they're Sunnis, and then they're Sunnis. And then they're, so, I mean, I don't think it's a natural state, but I think they've managed to put it together fairly well. Actually, believe it or not, they had a pretty good educational system, and people came from around the world sometimes for their medical treatment.
Yeah, so, I do remember at some point reading about Iraq. There were two things that come to mind. One was that at some point they had a law that that you had to learn how to read, and they actually had, and this included women, 100% literacy. I think,
yeah.
Well, you know, if you fail, if you can't read, you know, I guess they throw you in jail or something. I'm not saying it was a great place to live. But I always thought that was interesting that they were so hell-bent on providing education, even to the point of being ridiculous. And the other thing that I thought was interesting in this book that I read about Iraq was when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, there was a fair percentage of the people living in southern Iraq who had always assumed that Kuwait was actually part of Iraq.
Oh, yes.
And simply because the British had decided otherwise at some point, that wasn't going to keep them from taking it back.
Yeah, actually, I was over there about that time, or just before, and then again just after. But
what
yeah,
were you, what were you doing there?
I was, in my own way, trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem.
I mean, were you there in a capacity?
No, I wasn't there for a government or a corporation or anything. I was on my own,
research.
But... But I had contacts with the Israeli peace groups and the PLO, and that's more or less why I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in Iraq. But you're quite right. I mean, southern Iraq, basically under Secretary of State pretty much told Saddam Hussein, look, you can plow ahead and go into Kuwait, and we're not going to do much about it.
And then she went on vacation.
They went on vacation, and he went to Kuwait. But, yeah, historically, they've always treated it as one of their provinces. And it's oil rich, and, you know, Kuwaitis have, I mean, everybody there gets a college education, and they put propped up in business. It's a very wealthy state. There's no question about it, with not too many people in it. Tell you an interesting thing when I was there is, like, you're not supposed to have alcohol, just like in Saudi Arabia. But I was there on the Christmas day, and you would look out into the Persian Gulf, or what was then called the Arab Gulf from their side. Depends on what side you're on, they give the name to it. But and you would see these motherships, and then these little boats would go out, and they would get the booze. And they would bring it in, and all I know is that good scotch or good bourbon was going for as high as $500 a fifth.
Wow.
Christmas time.
Wow.
And everybody was drinking it. Of course, not officially, of course.
Yeah, no, not officially. Tell me a little bit about, let's talk about the media. You were a legal analyst for Fox. How did you come into that position from being a lawyer?
Well, the Rodney King case, maybe people remember that, you know, they beat up the black guy, and luckily a guy named George Halliday had his camera out and took pictures of it. And it's 81 seconds of the poor guy getting the shit beat out of him, and you got 20 cops standing around there with their arms folded doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyhow, what they did is they, for the first time, they started covering it as a trial. This is local Channel 11. And they invited lawyers down. They would have one for the morning session and one for the afternoon. They went through 30 or 40. And they invited me down one day, and then they invited me back again, and then I became the permanent legal analyst. And we had other people as guests, but I was actually employed as the legal commentator for KTTV in Los Angeles.
And tell me a bit about what it's like to be in that world where there's something important happening. The Rodney King case is still important today. And you're right there sort of bringing a lot of it to the
it really
people's
is,
homes.
It's really enjoyable. I mean, when I was doing like the first of the OJ case, for example, I spent like 10 hours a day on TV. Or, you know, and I would do a little bit of a show between 7 and 8, another between 8 and 9, and then all day long with maybe a 1 hour break. And then near the end, I came back for the news, and then we had a show at night. So, I mean, there was hardly any time off. But, you know, yeah, it's, you know, you get calls in and you get faxes and stuff. And the one thing you have to be a little bit careful about, a little bit more scrupulous than maybe I'd be tonight, where I can say whatever I think.
To not give your opinion
as much? Yeah, yeah. Well, you can sort of.
Or at all?
Yeah. Well, you just can't come out and say OJ's innocent or OJ's guilty or you get fired.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can marshal your facts.
Well, let me ask you, what are anchors like? What is it like to be sitting next to them? I mean, are they real people or are they androids?
No, generally, you know, I guess they vary, you know, like their lemons come in all colors. But it's like the ones I dealt with, you know, were really quite well informed. They knew how to, an anchor has to know how to entertain as well as just knowing the news. But they're constantly usually checking the internet for stories and things.
And this was, again, this was before Fox became the conservative mouthpiece that it
let's,
is today.
Let's don't confuse the local Channel 11 with the Fox network. I mean, yeah. I mean, I had no connection with them, and they're quite good at what they do, and it's a different skill. It's a skill in presentation, and also the way they you know, have to field questions in their ears all the time. You have to learn how to do that and at the same time carry on a conversation and change things. And know the timing and stuff because sometimes you have to cut for commercials. Now, doing OJ, we worked without commercials. And sometimes there where they would have these lengthy sidebars. I don't know if you recall it. But I know at one time there was one case where I talked for, I think it was 2 hours and 47 minutes because we had no commercials. And, you know, just telling stories as I went. You know, but that's a pretty long time to just talk as a monologue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you always interested in politics before you ended up on the news? I mean,
yeah, actually, I mean, I guess certainly by the time I was 15, I was raised in Florida. By the time I was 15 years of age, I think you would call me at least a bleeding heart liberal, really to the left of that. And
you're
so,
evildoer.
Yeah. I was, I didn't like organized religion. I certainly didn't like right wing politics, and so I was just a natural lefty. But I was also influenced by some of the books that I read. Clarence Darrow for defense. Clarence Darrow, the famous criminal lawyer, was my idol. And then actually, when I got married, Irving Stone, who wrote the book, ended up sitting at my head table at my wedding. He became a very good friend of mine.
Wow.
He wrote all these other books, you know, about agony and the ecstasy, and the book on Van Gogh and various Lust for Life and various others. So I was always interested in that, even in law school at UCLA. I came across the continent, bailed out of Florida, and went to law school at UCLA.
Do you think has it changed over the decades what it means to be a liberal? Do you think it's harder today or easier?
I suppose it really depends on where you are. I mean, we didn't have any liberals in most parts of Florida at the time. I mean, when I grew up, of course, you had segregated schools, drinking fountains, restrooms, and all of that. This was prior to the civil rights struggle. And if you're a liberal, you're just, in a little group of your own, maybe in a college. That's about it.
Oh, there's that weird liberal kid. Let's kick his butt.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's how I feel sometimes.
Yeah, it could be. But so UCLA was really a mind blower for me. I mean, really, because we actually had some real liberals there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because you come to a metropolitan area like L.A., and it was quite a breath of fresh air.
Let's talk about the president for a second, because we started out talking about the war and how they had these plans all along. I mean, Luke, is this really happening? Is this guy really our president? Is this administration for real? Or what's happened? Have we been hijacked by terrorists just with a different name, the neocon terrorists?
What's really scary is that we have to acknowledge that people are really driven by fear. If you get people afraid, then the people who are provoking with the fear, they're going to win. I mean, basically, it was 9/11 that got George Bush elected. Because, even though it was false, he tied that in with Iraq and the justification for going to Iraq.
Re-not elected.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then look at, look at all those states that voted for him because the fear that there would be they had one of the constitutional amendments so that gay people couldn't get married, for example. And I privately think that what was going through the minds of these persons that said, oh my God, what should happen if I have a son or a daughter who turns out to be gay, and comes out of the closet, and there's no more convincing way to come out of the closet than actually end up in a wedding ceremony, and they don't want to be embarrassed.
They don't want to be embarrassed by their children, so they just make it illegal.
Yeah, and I think I think, determined the election. I think if they didn't have those feelings and you didn't have those states, Ohio, of course, being one, I think you would have a different president.
So is the problem here that this country just has too many sort of mindless religious zealots? Or is the problem here or is it both, that we're simply being lied to and that the media is spreading this unholy fear of the truth?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, clearly, I think, in my view, I think we have too many religious zealots. Because the problem is that you get a religious figure and he's able to almost compel the attendance of I don't know how many people at whatever rally or the number of votes they can organize them and get them out because he speaks for God.
If I didn't know any better, I'd think Pat Robertson was the legal analyst for Fox now.
Well, you might as well be. I mean, look at the coverage they give him. I mean, the idiot says the same damn things over and over. I mean, somebody does something wrong or, he did the Katrina Earth Hurricane is because of letting Ellen DeGeneres MC the Emmys, or was it the Emmys? I think it was.
Right.
And now what's the latest one that
said? That basically
Ariel
drawing
Sharon.
A connection between Ariel Sharon's health problems and his change of heart with regard to being a hardliner in Israel,
yeah.
Which is interesting. It's interesting how you know, you would think this a Christian man would say, wouldn't occur to him that by Sharon deciding to kill less people on a given day, this is somehow a bad thing. But he's looking at this view of the Bible. The Bible says it's God's land, and apparently the people who live there, some of them aren't considered God's people, according to Pat Robertson. And he finds it perfectly appropriate. And, you know, he owns his own television station, so yeah. Which is really all the qualifications you need to be considered a major player in the media.
Yeah.
Which, again, I mean, look at Fox. You know, somebody conservative owns that, and he can do whatever he wants.
That's right.
And then he can say it's fair and balanced, even though it's neither fair nor balanced. You know, what do they care?
Right.
Who's going to stop them? Me? I'm an internet radio station.
True, true.
But, actually, I mean...
And to me, it's bizarre that when you have the right, the Christian right, standing up and saying, well, you know, actually that part of the country belongs to Jews, and they always make it look like they're very pro-Jewish or something, which they're really anti-Jewish.
Yeah, they believe in the rapture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you could ask three questions of a Pat Robertson or a Jerry Falwell, and if they would answer them and not dodge them, I mean, you would see them as the most intolerant thing in the world. If you asked either one of those people and said, now, what happens to you after you die? And they would tell you that according to their beliefs, you either go to heaven or hell. And then what have you got to do? What if you must do in order to go to heaven? Well, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your Savior.
Right.
And then the next question is, well, what happens to the people who don't, either because they've elected not to or they've never even heard of the dude? You know, we got a lot of people in the world never been exposed to it. And, you know, does that mean they go to hell? Now, they're not going to. That's the logical progression of what they're saying. But then they'll find some way to fidget around. Well, you know, we give them another chance or something. It becomes absolutely idiotic.
Yeah. And in their mind, you know, every Jew that dies, be it through some horrible homicide or through natural causes, they go into hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do they care? They don't watch my network anyway.
Well, you know, I just wonder what, you know, apparently Pat Robertson failed to charm his God enough, because I think 2 or 3 years ago his God inflicted prostate cancer on him.
Well, so, there you go.
There you go. Well, maybe he didn't pray hard enough. That's what they always say. Go ahead.
Let's talk about your past. We're doing your story in backwards chronological
okay.
order, which I'm
All
enjoying.
Right. All right.
So we last left you. You were a legal analyst for Fox, but before that, you were a well enough known lawyer to be asked to come down and talk about these stories.
Well, that's true.
How did you become a well known lawyer?
Well, I address this in my shows, but when they ask me, like, how did you become a lawyer? Genes, maybe. My grandfather, Roscoe Luke, became the youngest lawyer in the United States history at the age of 16, and he was the mayor of Thomasville, Georgia at 20.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, but they only had 11 years of school. And rumor has it in Thomasville, Georgia, where he was raised, that a fetus was the valedictorian of the high school 1 year.
But, no kidding.
Yeah. But at any rate, so I had people who were in the law, and then I was naturally drawn to it through Clarence Darrow and others, and went to law school. And because I was a liberal, you know, I volunteered to take on civil rights cases and anti-war cases, because I really, the christening period for me, when we had the Vietnam War going on, and I was in the midst of the civil rights struggle, so those were things that at least I found that I couldn't avoid, or didn't want to avoid, I wanted to get embroiled in. So those are the kinds of cases, I think, that got me the notoriety that then led to these other cases where, I think you and I discussed it before, but one point in, I guess, December of 1969, I represented all four of the leading cases in the United States. I represented Sirhan, who was accused of assassinating Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Charles Manson, who we've discussed before, the Black Panther Party of Southern California, and I had four cases for Geronimo Pratt, the Minister of Defense. And I represented Shirley Sutherland, who was the mother of Kiefer and the wife of Donald, and playwright Donald Freed, jointly charged with conspiracy to give hand grenades to the Black Panthers. So I had them all at the same time, and interesting thing is to hear what each one of them said about the other one. Because each one of them thought I should be only handling their cases.
Because the other people were crazy.
Oh, well, yeah. It's like, Manson, for example, wondered, you know, what was I doing representing blacks? Because, well, as Manson put it, it's like, God made the blacks strong and fast, but he gave the brains to the white race. And the Black Panthers were legitimately upset, though, because they used the expression off the pig, which didn't necessarily mean kill anybody, but get the oppressive police out of our community. And then we've got the word pig written in blood on Sharon Tate's residence, and then another expression like death to pigs on the LaBiancas. And the problem, we didn't have cameras in the courtroom in those days. They weren't allowed. But I'd be interviewed in the corridor, and on the nightly news, you may see back-to-back interviews with me, where here I am defending the Panthers, who use the expression off the pig, and then they would show pig written in blood in the Manson case, and they were afraid that there would be an impact on their cases by virtue of the connection with Manson, when actually they only had the same lawyer. The Sirhans, they couldn't understand why I was representing either Manson or the Panthers, because after all, they were criminals.
Right. So, you know, so it was a battle of semantics then.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Manson is a name that sticks out, you know, as, you know, it just has a big ring to it, you know. It's like, Manson, that crazy guy. And, you know, when I first tell people that, you know, oh, I have this friend and he represented Manson, you know, the reaction is always very interesting, because it's always like, like I said, he represented Hitler or something like that, you know. And I'm sure you came across a lot of that after, you know, since and during. And so, what is it? I mean, tell me first why you thought it was a case worth taking, and then tell me about, you know, what was it like being the lawyer for such an unpopular case.
Well, let me start with the fact that actually I was spit upon by a lawyer's wife. He was a criminal defense lawyer and should have known better, but somehow, you know, this is a case you shouldn't be taking. But the reason I took it really was to put the death penalty on trial, because I figured if I could, at that point it looked like Manson was, the evidence was overwhelming. But then I felt that if he was convicted, if I could get the jury to give him life imprisonment, then it was a piece of cake for anybody that came afterward on the death penalty issue, because it would be very hard to argue that the next guy that came along had committed more diabolical murders than committed in that case.
So your objective wasn't to prove him innocent or clean or anything like that?
Initially, I figured that they had overwhelming evidence. Now, it turned out when I represented him, which was only for like a month and a half, that the evidence was quite thin. Now, ultimately, it developed differently, but and Manson got out of control, and one thing led to another. But at that time, my original reason for taking it was to put the death penalty on trial, because I had three basic arguments against the death penalty. I've met very few people who've been resurrected, innocent people who were executed and then resurrected. Very few.
Yeah, I haven't met any.
Four,
actually.
Four and a half, actually.
Really?
Yeah. And the second is that, a third, actually, is that the entire civilized world, for the most part, has rejected capital punishment and leaves the United States as like the lone social Neanderthal. And another one, actually, is the discriminatory way in which it's put to use, so that economic circumstances and race are the primary reasons that a person either lives or dies, and it usually turns out to be poor black males.
Which is really the simplest argument against it, which is you have a permanent form of punishment for a fluid, inefficient justice system. So
that's true.
How can you? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't at all. And some people who say, you know, the question that sometimes comes up is like, wait a minute, are you saying that there's nobody aren't there some people this planet would be better off without? I mean, how about Hitler if he's alive, or Manson? You know? The problem there is you can't write a death penalty law unless you're a psychic. It says, you know, if and when Hitler comes along, we're going to deal with him differently than everybody else, or Eichmann for that matter.
Well, then it isn't law.
Yeah, you can't do that. You basically end up having to put this in the lap of 12 people who've never met one another and with their own backgrounds and prejudices and idiosyncrasies, and then they come in where you get crazy quilt results. And one part of the country may get one result and one another, and, you know. Anyhow, it ends up being very difficult to harmonize these different verdicts. And so, as I say, there are about three countries of the few that are left. There are about three countries a year more that are doing away with the death penalty. So it's only a matter of time. But the United States has the death penalty, and Afghanistan and North Korea and Iran,
Sudan.
Iraq, Syria. Yeah, it's a few others.
And even of countries that have the death penalty, we have a particularly bizarre.
You know, your beloved president, for example, my gosh, I mean, Texas executes more people than all the other 49 states put together.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when George Bush was there.
Yeah, I love this president so much, I rigged one of those machines, so every time I voted for him, it counted as 1,000 votes.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
And Bush himself, I mean, he comes from this, you know, wonderful history of having executed more people than anybody I can think of.
That's true.
And do you think, not necessarily just related to the death penalty. I mean, I was saying one of the things that makes our death penalty situation even worse than some of these other countries that are still hanging on to the death penalty is we still have laws that we have a system in place that enables us to execute people who committed crimes when they were 17 or younger,
yeah,
even.
Yeah.
We've executed the mentally ill. We still have... In fact, it was Bush who it was, you know, one of his famous.
That's right.
Making fun of, what was her name? Tucker, I think it was, or the woman who found. God, it's embarrassing. I can't remember her name, but she found God at the end, and then he was like making fun of her.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he killed her. And then we just executed Tookie Williams.
Yeah, and then you got next Tuesday they're going to execute a guy who's blind and you know in a wheelchair and feebled and so forth, and then. Actually, I was going to submit a skit to Saturday Night Live where they basically bring him in with a seeing eye dog into like a Letterman or Leno environment, you know, and you say, you know, what chair am I supposed to sit in? You know,
oh,
and they sit him down in there, you know, and it's, yeah, it's just, get him out of the way, you know.
And, you know, nobody's arguing that any of these people, I mean, I know innocent people have been executed and a lot of people recently through DNA evidence and everything have been exonerated, but... But, you know, even people who are guilty and it's understood that they're guilty, that I don't, you automatically go, well, that person's guilty, and then that means we should have a death penalty in place. And you either have to have it or you can't have it. You can't just have it for one person or another person. And,
also, you know, I think we just haven't evolved very much as a species. But, there's always a reason or reasons why people do things. It may not be reasons we applaud, but... Society, if you look enough into, because I represent all these notorious people, and it's really not like they've had the richest and most exciting of lives. They're not in that wonderful 70% in Iraq that are supposedly really enjoying themselves.
Really enjoying themselves.
I mean, you know, and it's like we need to give them their comeuppance. So what we do is, my God, the only way you can get even is to execute them or put them in prison for all these years. I mean, if we're really serious about preventing crime, then we've got to deal with the social causes of crime, and we won't do that. We just refuse. We won't appropriate anything. I mean, there's...
Well, since we're intentionally going in the opposite direction of that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. My favorite oxymoron is, where in the hell did this compassionate conservative idea come from? I mean, but, you know, I mean, these conservatives basically, it's like, you know, Abramoff or whatever his name is. I mean, he's a typical right-wing, I mean, Republican kind of thing. They basically... You want to be very self-centered, and that's it. And they have people feeling that, my God, every time the government does something, it's wrong. But would you like a police force that's – well, maybe they would, but a private police force, private fire department. I mean, you got
– They want to privatize everything.
Yeah. That's.
They could they privatize the oxygen if they could.
No, they sure would. They sure would.
But they use compassionate conservatism because fascist dictatorship doesn't sound as nice.
That's right. That's true.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, I'm firm and you're pig-headed. We're talking about the same thing.
Do you think that there's a fundamental flaw, coming from the perspective of a lawyer and legal background, do you think there's a fundamental flaw in our adversarial system that as opposed to a trial being about getting to the truth of a situation, it's really more about one side trying to prove a point against the other side, trying to prove the opposite point. And if the truth happens to come up at some point in between, that's probably an inconvenience anyway.
I don't think so, although sometimes that can happen because it's just like, you know, you hear about all these trials in the media, you know, where somebody got off and you say, Jesus, you know, how did O.J. Simpson get off? Or maybe some person who's wrongly convicted. And of course, when these things happen, they're spotlighted. But I think generally speaking, assuming you've got competent lawyers on both sides, I mean, you've really got a police force that's not in the business of coddling criminals. You've got a prosecutor who's hell bent on getting a conviction. You got a judge who supposedly is the arbiter, and a jury who's not preconceived. It's not committed to either side. So I think, generally speaking, you know, that's probably the best way of getting at the truth. Now, in an ideal world, I mean, in Plato's Republic or something, you could have a French system where you have judges investigate and do all this. The problem is that, you know, if you do that and you don't have the background for it or the historical antecedents, I mean, could you imagine Bush and all his people making decisions? I mean, you'd never get a fair trial that way.
No.
I mean, there's something, the word adversary sort of suggests it's nasty, but... And it doesn't always work out. But, it, you know, percentage-wise, I'd say that in most cases you end up with the the truth being found out. And sometimes when you see impediments to truth, like, let's say, the suppression of illegal search and seizures, there are reasons for it. I mean, it was the reason principles like that were put in, so, like, you can't use coerced confessions or illegal the products of an illegal search and seizure, because it was found that was the only way to stop the police from gouging information out of people or just breaking into people's homes, as they can now do in so many ways under the Patriot Act, an excuse.
What is the deal with that? Is my understanding that the way it's set up with FISA is that you can actually wiretap someone for 72 hours without a warrant, mm-hmm. and then if you decide that you're going to, you know, continue to wiretap them, you then need to go and get a warrant. There's a system in place. You fill out a form or whatever. You know, you get a stamp. And the big argument here is that the Bush administration feels that they shouldn't have to even do that.
That's right.
And we're talking about, you know,
yeah.
3 or 4 days of being able to wiretap someone with no warrant. This is actually legal. But it's not good enough for them.
Right.
And is it just that they think they can get away with it?
I think it really is, because I don't really think Bush is a principled man, and I don't think that his group of thugs are principled either. I think they think they can get away with it. But also, it's clever how they go about it. I mean, basically, it's the old argument. They say, look, terrorism is a big thing. We have to fear it. And they know they scare people by doing that. And then they say, look, we can't do these things. Now, and the other people will say, well, can't you show us why it is you need to know every book that a person reads in a library or they check out of a bookstore and so forth? Why do you have to do that? Well, we can't show you that. Because if we do that, then the other side will know, the terrorists will know, and they'll do something differently.
Oh, I thought you meant the Democrats.
They're
always referring to the other side.
Yeah, I'm sure that the Democrats are terrorists.
Apparently half of my country is evil, according to the president.
Yeah, but, you know, to me it's just modern McCarthyism. It's like, you know, I have so many communists in the State Department, and well, where are they? Where's the list, Senator? Well, I can't show you that because we won't be able to pursue them. Yeah, what Bush is saying all the time is like,
good impression. That's
yeah, I've never done it before either. This first time. You know what? But what I really want to do is to build a boys' camp. No, it's what they're basically saying is, look, the ordinary rules don't apply because of terrorism, and you need us, Big Brother, sitting here to do it. And when we have to call upon the justify, we say, well, we can't do that because to divulge that would just, you know, the enemy would get hold of it. So you have to trust us. So, and that's a pretty scary proposition. Says I, at least I don't trust them anyhow.
And the enemy getting hold of this, can't we just torture it out of them then?
Well, I think we do that. And, you know,
that,
apparently,
I mean, obviously, but, I'm being sarcastic.
But, you know,
but
we don't, I'm sure we do that. So, I think that the people in there will do whatever they can get away with. I don't see any evidence that they have any respect for law and order, though they pretend that they do. I think they're interested in. I think they're interested in staying in, you know, being elected and staying in office.
Is that really all they want? Like, I keep racking my brain trying to figure out the Bush administration has done so many absurd and peculiar things that, in my mind, can only serve to be for, you know, bad reasons. But why would someone want to always be bad? And so in the end, I guess my question is, what the hell do they actually want? Is it just power? Is it just to continue to be reelected? Or are they really working on some sort of broader philosophical, are they trying to change the hearts and minds of the universe or something like that?
Well, they might subjectively, but that's also scary. I mean, as much as I despise Pat Robertson, and I do, and Jerry Falwell, probably within their own little, their mind, they probably think that they're carrying out God's work and doing all this shit. I mean, and Bush, I'm sure, feels like that he knows best what to do. You know, but I think, and therefore, once they've adopted that stance, they're willing to do anything to get that result, because you can't have those goddamn Democrats or the people to the left of them, certainly, outdoing, you know, in office, because, you know, I don't know. I mean, I come, because of my anti-religious bent, I always come back to the same thing. I wonder, like, Pat Robertson and others, but let's just pick on him for a minute. Or George Bush, he'll say, you know, I prayed for this and that. You know, what do they really hear in these prayers? Does Pat Robertson close his eyes and then suddenly God speaks to him? Is it a male voice, a female voice? Does she have a southern accent? English language, of course, but I assume that God has a translator. But that's the silliest thing in the world. But I can't imagine how a grown person can believe this shit. I mean, I've never had God talk to me, and yeah. I've never met anybody I had any respect for. I believe that ever since God had talked to them.
Yeah, I try to avoid going too deeply into that in my own mind, because in general, I agree with you. But then I also know a lot of people who are intelligent, who I respect, who consider themselves religious people. Of course, they don't go around saying stuff like, God told me this, God told me that, or I met Putin and I saw his soul. But, I mean...
Well, how about just simple, moderate things like blaming the hurricanes and Sharon's illness on the fact that they haven't followed his social
policy? Or supporting
intelligent
design. I don't get it. I don't know. Tell me about. Let's take a break from politics. Although I think that's going to be impossible. But tell me about a case. In any case, it doesn't have to be a big case. In which, in the end, you know, you were involved, and in the end, you felt justice was served, and you were really glad that you were a part of it.
Well, I really think there are a lot of those, but I mean, one of them that I'm going to be doing in my show tomorrow. In 1967, there were a lot of protests against the Vietnam War. But the tide hadn't quite turned. It wasn't quite to the point where Lyndon Johnson figured he couldn't run for office again and be successful. So I defended two college professors against charges that they had basically chased the Dow Chemical Company recruiters off the campus at Cal State LA. And it was a trial that lasted about a month. And at the end of it, the jury only deliberated 2 hours before they exonerated both of them. And what was happening is they would come on there as this... recruiters for Dow, and Dow was the exclusive manufacturer of napalm, and I'm sure we all probably remember it. They would napalm villages
napalm.
And the crops and the people, and so what I decided to do is a lesson I really learned from Clarence Darrow by transposing roles and circumstances. Is I had the jury imagine that suppose a madam or some greasy pimp was invited by the chancellor of the university to come on campus and try to sign up their daughters to do some work in a whorehouse. And then the daughter writes back and says, you know, thank you, Mommy and Daddy, for recommending this school. I'm going to go out and sell my I've learned a lot from my education. I'm going to go out and sell my soul and my body. So, and I said, you know, would you protest? And I could see the jury suddenly said, you know, would that changed arrangement or something? They said, well, shit, we'd kick them off campus in a minute. And I said, well, my clients, you know, they were opposed to the war, which is 10,000 miles away, but people were being mutilated. I mean, we killed 2 million, quote, slant-eyed gooks. In Vietnam, let's not forget that. But all we talk about are the 58,000 American lives that were lost. Mm-hmm. So we're over there and we're dropping napalm on people, and you don't see who you're killing; you just are and burning them alive. And people are there on campus recruiting. Say, yeah, come with us. We're going to have bigger and better napalm. You're going to be paid well.
They didn't have what do they call it now? Smart targets? Or
oh
something
yeah,
like that?
Smart bombs and stuff. Oh yeah,
that only kill bad people. I think is how they work.
Yeah, that's right. That's amazing.
Only kill people that deserve to die.
Absolutely. And the way you figure out whether they deserve to die is by those people who were killed. It's a little bit of a circular argument.
Yeah.
If they're dead, they deserved it.
Pat Robertson himself, he blesses the bombs before we drop them so that they don't kill any innocent people.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it should be. Sort of baptize the A bomb, baptize the smart bombs. And...
So I'm sorry. Please continue.
No. So I'd say that's one kind of case. I defended a number of the civil rights cases and stuff. I actually defended one protest case where I got had my clients sing in court. It's the only time it's ever happened before. At the end, they sang "We Shall Overcome," and the jury was in tears.
What was the context of that?
It was what was called a shop-in. Back in the first year, I was practicing law privately, and I volunteered. I did stuff for the American Civil Liberties Union, and. There were people picketing the Van de Kamp Bakery section of a local thrifty mart, and there was heavy discrimination in employment. I mean, there were no blacks at all in the managerial or administrative staff. There were 50 truck drivers, none were black. You know, 550 people in the bakeries, if five were black. It was just overwhelming. And they said, we're not going to talk to you. We got the power. You don't. Go fuck yourself. So anyhow, it was the same kind of defense, basically, and I went through the history of the civil rights movement. And talked about, you know, how they got to where they were, and I basically blessed the, not in Pat Robertson sense, but the defendants for having the courage to have their convictions and put their, one guy was a probation officer, put their professional lives on the line, and ultimately the jury agreed with me, and so those cases are quite gratifying. Now, realistically, you know, I mean, you have to make some money, you have to practice law, so I don't want to pretend that I can just pluck out these jewels and defend these ideal cases. I mean,
sure.
You still end up having, you're lucky. If you're really lucky, if you go out and do it, maybe you can get a half of 50% of your cases are ones you really, really would like to defend. Or maybe, you know, sometimes, like when I grew up, I mean, the people were being put in prison in Texas for one marijuana cigarette. Candy Bar, who died a few days ago, went to prison for something like that. And people, college students were getting like felonies on their app, so they get on their record, and having to do some jail time for like one cigarette or something, smoking marijuana. And the people who were sitting there were people who were so drunk half the time that, you know, they're lucky they could even see the jury and everybody else. I mean, it was just
the drunk leading the blunted.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Exactly. And in those cases, I think even, you know, there's some cases that, I mean, who cares what the law is? If the law is unjust, you know, then you know, you hope that justice will catch up with the law. Because, I mean, I got a great pleasure out of anything I could do to cheat them out of convictions in those dope cases because the penalties were so ridiculously severe and they were ruining lives for no purpose. So a lot of my cases were narcotics cases. I mean, most criminal lawyers that do things, you make money, it's usually off narcotics and drug cases and white-collar crimes. I mean, that's how you pay the rent.
Wow. We're about to confirm a new justice who seems pretty clearly to be under the delusion that Roe v. Wade isn't like a really important thing, that, you know, isn't really law, and that there's nothing in the Constitution that really guarantees a woman's right to, her body, mm-hmm. her choice. Are we in deep shit? I mean, is that where is this really going to happen?
The real difficulty.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing the little show on CNN, where they pretend to ask them questions that matter. But in the end, it looks to me like this guy's going to get confirmed. Are we really at risk here of people losing the right to choice?
Maybe they need one more vote, but they're close to it as it is. I mean, Louis, you've got one Justice Stevens on there who's 84 years of age. You don't know how long he's going to make it. So, I mean, they're only maybe one vote away or two. But, you know, it's not just Roe v. Wade. You've got a number of decisions. Roe v. Wade, you had a couple of vote margin, but you've got some embroidering of important decisions that came down on the heels of Roe v. Wade. They only elect one vote differential. Mm. And if you take Roberts and the new guy and put him in there, and, you know, I mean, they can keep chipping away at it until finally they're set up for a couple of years down the line saying, well, you know, we think the underpinnings of Roe v. Wade don't stand, so we're going to just totally overrule it. Yeah, I think there's a risk there. I don't really know what's going to happen.
Thanks for the good news, Luke.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to lie to you like your government?
I want you to lie to me like the government. I want you to tell me that everything's going to be okay.
You know, I feel like I can.
Luke, is everything going to be okay? You can just tell me everything's
going to be okay. Yeah, it really is. And I'm telling that because I want you to sleep well tonight.
Thank you.
I want you to be like one of those seven Iraqis that you were telling me about. The 7 out of 10.
They're very happy
That's
with their
great.
Life.
What kind of medicine are they giving them over there? So they what do they give them before they vote?
Generics, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Tell me about Wounded Knee, and yeah. I know you discussed that in your show. We have a little bit of time left, so after you tell me about that, we'll talk about your show, which is tomorrow night, and who knows when.
Well,
and
I defended the Native Americans at Wounded Knee in 1973.
And what was that?
All right. Well, the original Wounded Knee in 1890 was the last military skirmish between the government and the Native Americans, and they massacred 300 Sioux, and they all were buried in one mass grave. And this was a return to that. It's too complicated really to discuss in a minute or two, except there are all kinds of injustices. Where Wounded Knee, the reservation, it's a tiny hamlet of maybe 300 people on what's called the Pine Ridge Reservation. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs that operates through the Department of Interior, they have their own police. And anyhow, the guy running the tribal government was an ex-bootlegger, an embezzler. And, I mean, they get the federal monies to take care of people. The average person there, it was the lowest, the most poverty-ridden county in the whole country. The average, like, $800 a person. And, but he's paying his brother, like, $25,000 and all this. So it's corruption and all this stuff. So the militant Indians, who were really influenced by the civil rights struggle and the Black Panthers and some third world struggles, said, you know, we want to put an end to this. So they took a caravan. You got 600 Indians from 75 tribes around the country, and they hole up in Wounded Knee, and sure enough, the American military went on the attack. In the end, remember a guy named Alexander Haig? Does that name mean anything to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he ended up saying, you know, like, well, we're going to military attack here, but he told them, he says, look, dress up in civilian outfits and take all your military equipment and put them in, like, civilian vehicles. It was run from Nixon all the way down. It was
amazing.
It was a military attack, and they killed a couple of Indians. And then when I was there, they had 164 FBI agents in charge of that case when I was there as their chief counsel. And they only had 157 investigating Watergate. So it was, and we were in an apartment building. The FBI took up the adjacent apartments, both on the left and side and the right. They were bugging us, and we were bugging them. And it got to be a really fierce thing. And a couple of years later, when it eventuated in trial, all the cases were dismissed. the judge finding that the government had committed perjury and all kinds of other things, and so that's the way it ended up. But the lot of an Indian, even today, is pretty bad. I mean, you know, they just, you know, they live on these reservations, and the ground doesn't grow fertile crops, and they have to really depend upon whatever the government gives them. And then the tribal chiefs are so corrupt that the money doesn't get to the people.
Yeah, I understand the law in the United States is that Native Americans are supposed to be guaranteed health care, unlike the rest of America. And apparently, I heard something on the radio. This was maybe like a year or so ago. The kind of health care they get is just a little worse than the health care that's given to federal prisoners.
Yeah. Oh, it's worse.
And so a lot of Native Americans, you know, if they're sick or they fall down a well and break their leg or something like that, avoid going to the hospital because they know to get fixed up, they're not going to be able to afford it.
Well, that's very true. And let me say this. The Wounded Knee is on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Can you believe this, that half of the people who are 40 years of age there have diabetes? The average life expectancy is 48 for men, 52 for women.
This is in the United States. This
yes,
is happening
yes.
in our country.
And they have the highest rate of alcoholism in the entire country. I mean, and the kind of nutrition they get, obviously, isn't very good. So, I mean, yeah, they, you know, Indians are just treated just like, like animals, you know. So, but there aren't enough of them. You know, there aren't enough of them enough of them, and they're organized in such a way to really be able to do anything. It's sad.
It's interesting how, you know, when I was a kid, and like in school, and we're, you know, in social studies, and we learned about the Indians and the Pilgrims, and you learn about the country and how it developed, and how it was all about honor and truth and liberty, and this idea that. You know, that this country, unlike other countries, is based on the idea that you're supposed to do what's right. Even if it's not what's best for you, you're supposed to do what's right for everybody. And that's sort of a fundamental part of democracy. And yet, from its inception, I mean, when you look at... there's not a treaty we didn't break that I'm aware of. You know, and that's the beginning, that's the birth of this country. So really, it starts with a lie. And then you have to keep repeating the lie, which is what they're doing now, what the Bush administration does now. They keep repeating the lie until it becomes truth, because it's all you ever hear.
Can I tell you a couple of very quick idiot jokes? The first time the Europeans came to the United States, or wasn't the United States then, but came to the what's now called the United States, and the Indians observed the Europeans arriving, you know, and they, you know what one said to another? There goes the neighborhood. And you know what they called the,
that's
this
an
country?
Old one, Luke.
Yeah, no. You know what they called this country before it was called, before the Europeans came? Ours.
Ours?
Yeah. Now, there are a bunch of wonderful jokes. But they did, incidentally, they did a survey during Wounded Knee when I was there and so forth, and they found out that only 15% of Americans thought that the United States should get out of Vietnam, and Nixon was excited. But if he'd have read a little further, 85% felt that we should get out of America. They get out of America.
So we have just a few minutes left. Yeah. Tell us all about your show. What is it? It's a one-man show, and where can it be seen? And tell
us
all about it.
It's a one-man show I'm doing tomorrow night. That's Wednesday, January 11th. That's starting at 7 o'clock in the Hollywood Court Theater, which is on the second floor of the United Methodist Church in Hollywood at the corner of Highland and Franklin.
Which a lot of people don't know actually is not just a church, but there's an actual theater in there.
Absolutely.
And it's a beautiful stage.
Very, very nice theater with several dressing rooms, and the acoustics are good and so forth. And we just, you know, moved into it a few months ago. And so it should be nice. And I deal with political topics and in cases that I've handled. But there's a lot of, you know, fun involved in it too, a lot of, because legal cases is really many of them are very fascinating because they have little humorous angles.
Well,
and
sure.
I try to put some of that in there, but I'll be talking primarily in tomorrow's show. I have like 3 one-man shows about Charles Manson and Wounded Knee, and then the defense of the Dow Chemical case that I mentioned earlier, and then a few really unusual little cases. So it's a pretty rare experience.
And
it's $10 for people to come, and all that goes to our we're First Stage, which is a nonprofit corporation. I mean, I don't get any of this money, and it goes to First Stage, and we're all volunteers. Nobody is paid to do things for the theater.
And what is First Stage? What's the point of First Stage?
All right, First Stage basically is a nonprofit theater group, and the primary thing that we're known for is staged readings, where many famous playwrights have started with their plays being actually read there. But they're also performances. I mean, The thing I really enjoy the most is we put on an event called Playwrights Express every spring. And for $40, any playwright in the country, we guarantee doing at least a stage read. And usually it's in between. It's not like a bunch of people sitting in chairs. It's in between a staged reading and the actual performance of a person's play. And then for $30, they can get the video. I don't think you can find any place in the country that's like that. And we get like 150 plays a year, and they come from all over. And I think that's sort of exciting. And we just finished a one-act contest. We had 151 plays submitted. And so basically, you know, we give it, we're a place that gives playwrights a chance to do things. And we have some wonderful actors, including yourself, who've performed there and do these things. And I think it's a fascinating, it's a different kind of thing. We don't specialize in productions, though. We're moving in that direction. But it's a wonderful opportunity for writers and for actors. So we'd love to have some people join us also.
And is there a website or a place people get more information?
Yes, there is. You can call for, look up on the
he
web.
He asked him knowingly.
Yeah, firststagela.com or org. I think either one will work.
I think it's org.
Okay, org.org. Yeah, firststage.org. And that should give the information.
Firststagela.org.
Firststagela.org. You got it. You got it.
Excellent. What's the name of your show?
It's called Luke Lawyer Against the Odds, because primarily they're the troublesome cases that other people wouldn't touch, and it's me against the establishment.
Fantastic. My guest today has been Luke McKissick, Lawyer Against the Odds. You've been listening to a special edition of the Kill Radio News. I'm John, signing off. Anybody wants to listen to more of me, you can listen Thursday morning to my music show, Is Good. My guest will be Firebug. You can check out her music at myspace.com/firebug. Until next week, hang in there. Be well. Be very, very well.